Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Rose. It's Sunday the 2nd of July, and it's a season finale, which will see us take a well-earned break for the summer. We have a smorgasbord of guests for you today, so get the kettle on or grab a nice cold tinny and enjoy the next hour of entertainment in the small cap space. What news have we had this week, Kev? Well, the big story was the failed or aborted coup on Moscow as the Wagner group headed from Rostov-on-Don to Moscow in a 25,000 plus convoy, touted as an attempt to overthrow Putin. What did you make of that? It was a bizarre sort of 12 hours of news on that front, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very strange.
Yeah, man, Wagner's obviously a bit of a loose cannon, to say the least, but Putin thought he had him under control, and obviously he didn't. I don't think we've heard the end of him. I've seen reports they're in Belarus, are they, and they're setting up camp. So don't think we've heard the end of him. What it does do is it weakens the Russian forces at the front line for sure. So yeah, let's see what happens. But I think obviously from a market point of view, it's the instability of everything that's the issue. So yeah, this week we've seen the dollar rise again because everybody's ran for safety. Gold's gone down, which is bizarre, but that, I think that's mainly because of the fact that the dollar has increased in value. Yeah, what can I say? The sooner it gets sorted out, the better. But I mean, we're talking about a man who obviously it must be close to insanity in terms of...
I mean, some say it's weakened his position, but actually when you read it, if you look at it more in depth, you could argue it's probably strengthened his position. But it is interesting that this guy runs Wagner. So it's almost like, be careful what you wish for. Do you actually want him to overthrow Putin? You know what I mean? It's almost like better the devil you know. I mean, I think the US and China remain quite sort of silent on it because they were under the concern of, well, actually, do we really want Prigozhin in, you know, running Russia with, you know, he's meant to be quite a brutal guy, isn't he? They call him the chef or Putin's chef, and he's had quite a coloured background. But yeah, it is interesting. It was weird that it was like, I sent you the article, I think, on Friday night, and I said, watch this space, this could get interesting. And it literally, on the Saturday morning, it all just flooded the news. You saw them in the convoy. Loads of the generals who were obviously helping Putin have now gone missing effectively, and they haven't been in contact with the families for 3 or 4 days. So, you know, you don't know what. But it is interesting that has it allowed Ukraine to reposition, to advance more towards the east? I guess we'll find out in the long term, won't we?
Yeah. But the reality is it needs to be sorted out one way or the other for the whole world, not just for Russia and Ukraine. And yeah, I pray that that's the case. And then in the other big news, we've got the second Ashes test, which Australia went in and battered extremely well.
And England have responded well, haven't they, on the Friday?
Well, England responded well on Thursday, and then flipping dropped the ball on Friday morning, didn't they? Because effectively they went from 212 or something like that for one.
One, yeah.
To all out for 325.
I didn't see that. So they were all, yeah, I saw that your man had, he was like 115 for one at one point. I think that was the last, but he had a really good innings.
And then the Aussies have come back in now, and they've got a lead of 110 at lunchtime on the Friday. Obviously, you know when we're recording this now, so we don't know what's going to happen after that, but I think it's going to probably be 2-0 by the time you get to this.
I mean, to be honest, you look at the England women's team as well, they were really close, weren't they? And they sort of, it just all fell apart, didn't it, in the last few wickets. It was, you know, a similar story, wasn't it? But it's been an exciting series so far, and Well, yep. We'll move on to our first guest, I guess. We're joined by Mark Routh, CEO of Prospects Energy. Welcome, Mark. It's been a while. How's life treating you?
Yes, thank you for having me. It's been busy, and finally good to get some good news out there.
Yeah, so obviously that news you're alluding to. Just last week, it was announced that Prospects has received all necessary approvals for gas production at the Podere Meyer well in the Selva field in northern Italy. The final safety checks by UNMIG and the local fire department have been completed, and the Italian Energy Ministry has issued formal documentation for production commencement. Gas production is expected to begin in early July 2023, following an 8-day administrative period. Prospects holds a 37% working interest in the Selva Malvezzi production concession with Po Valley Operations as the operator. Sounds like things are finally coming together at Selva, Mark.
Yes, at last. It might seem a long, long time, but best things come to those who wait. I mean, a gas plant and processing plant at Selva Malvezzi was installed safely, and I went to visit this site in April. Po Valley's done an excellent job there. We were waiting for a signature from the fire department, but unfortunately the floods in the Po Valley were devastating and the fire department was very busy rescuing people from the floods. So we couldn't get an appointment for them to come and inspect the kit until mid-June. That happened on the 15th of June. The signatures went up to the central ministry and they signed it off last Monday, and that's when we announced yesterday.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, in the RNS, you expressed confidence in the upcoming production and cash flow from the asset. Do you want to add some colour to this?
Well, yeah, we're looking at upwards of £320,000 per month of income from the field when it gets into full production. Now, for the balance of 2023, you know, that's more than £1.5 million. That's going to change our PE ratios. That's going to change our earnings per share. The trouble is, you know, what's the market value going to be? And with you work your PE ratio out, and you've got two unknown numbers. You've got the market value, the numerator, and then the denominator is the earnings per share. It can be quite subjective, but I'm expecting the current PE ratio of 2 or 3 to be rising to much higher numbers.
Okay, Mark. I mean, I suppose we've had delays on this. So you were hoping this was going to come earlier, but as you say, we're waiting for those that wait. We get reward. So tell us a bit about what's been happening in the gas market in general, because I mean, I think it's been up and down like nobody's business over the last sort of year or so. How do you see it in that time frame and going forward?
The gas at Selva is going to be sold linked to the TTF price in the Netherlands. It's a premium to the TTF initially, but then we have a small discount for transportation with our gas marketers. The gas price did indeed go nuts as a result of the Ukraine war. And at that time, we were producing in Spain and we had prices going up to ridiculous levels in Spain where we were producing gas and generating electricity. But the forward curve has softened, as everyone can see. But I'm seeing forward curve gas prices for 2024 starting to firm up. And we're going to be heading into a winter where there could be a bit of a crunch with energy. And gas is always the go-to fuel when it comes to there being a pinch. And in my opinion, local indigenous onshore gas is the best thing to be turning to, not least because it has a far lower carbon footprint than importing LNG from abroad.
Yeah, how in Italy, for a long time there, it was a major problem getting the licenses for these things. So remind listeners really what the situation was in terms of getting the license for this, and also how can you progress this field, if you like, because amount of gas that's going to come out, how do you expect this to continue on over the next 12 months, 24 months, 36 months in terms of the field?
Well, we've got three drillable structures on the production concession, which would add further resources and reserves to our portfolio. We are applying for licenses to drill those three structures, and we'll probably do those back to back as soon as we can get the permits to drill. The difference is, I mean, when I took prospects on, people were saying, what are you doing that for? You'll never get permission to produce gas in Italy. However, there's been a change of heart. We've had, obviously, the global situation changing hugely. But there's also been a change of government in Italy. And the ministry has been renamed significantly, in my opinion, the Ministry of Environment and Energy Security. So the fact is that local onshore gas in Italy is now being blessed by the government. That's not to say that bureaucracy is still there. We still have to, you know, wait 8 days from signature until we can produce the gas, which is something complete. I don't understand why, but that's just the way it works. But yeah, some people say you'll never get it. And here we are, and we're just about to be producing gas from this onshore field where the costs are extremely low.
Okay. And what sort of time frame do you think you could be looking at for the three extra wells to be drilled, as in when do you perceive? I know it's how long is a piece of string, and we're talking about Italy here. So, but I mean, what general time scale do you think you have? And we don't like time scales, but
yeah,
general time scales.
Realistically, I'm planning for early 2024. It's going to be subject to a lot of things, obviously. But significantly, we don't have to go through the whole environmental seismic monitoring process and all of that stuff that you have to do to get production concession. because we've already got the production concession. All we need to do is permit each individual well, and significantly, we need to talk to the landowners of the sites from where we're drilling in order to compensate them and make sure that we can use their land. And it's usually discussion which the local community is very supportive. So I don't think there's going to be a problem with that. It's just something that has to be done and takes a bit of time.
And PM, Mark, these are the ones that you've alluded to in the past. It's Selver North, Selver South, and obviously East Selver as well. I think there's also Riccardina, which is deeper as well. Are they the targets?
Yes. Now, Selver North and South are contingent resources because they're considered part of the Selver structure. East Selver is an exploration prospect, as is Riccardina. Now, Riccardina is deeper and has a higher risk factor. And currently, the joint venture doesn't have plans to drill Riccardina, but that is one for the future, which we might consider with further seismic reprocessing, which we're doing at the moment over the concession.
Sure. Let's talk a bit about Spain then. You know, we've talked in the past about El Romeral and Tesorillo. How frustrating is that for you? Because I know you want to kind of get onto those as soon as possible.
So the Tesorillo license in Spain, there's an exploration permit, which was suspended just prior to the COVID lockdowns. In May 2021, we applied to convert the exploration permit into a production concession. The Spanish ministry has acknowledged that application, which went in before the Climate Change Act was passed in May 21. They've acknowledged that, but they haven't done anything with it. So we're waiting to get response from the central ministry in Madrid. But in the meantime, we've got wells to be drilled in the Romeral concession. And in Romeral, we've got three concessions which have discovered gas prospects, which we could tie into the power plant through our local gas network and generate electricity from the gas produced. The power plant is only operating at 30% capacity, just one of the three engines running at a time, because we have insufficient gas to burn. So we've applied for these five wells. And again, we're waiting for the response from the Spanish ministry in Madrid.
So coming back to Italy in terms of the, I remember we talked about this, I don't know, maybe it was 6 months ago, that the gas was going to come online. And at that time, the price was mental, as you said. As a long-term price indication, what do we think is going to be the situation in terms of prospect energy for you guys?
I think that the long-term European gas prices are not going to fall anytime soon. And I see it actually going up quite significantly from the current levels. We're already seeing the forward curve heading towards 50 and 60 euros per megawatt hour. You know, it went up much higher than that. You know, beginning of the year, it was 70 or 80. It's come down to around 30 for a while, but the forward curve is firming up. And I see there being a bit of an energy crunch in Europe. So you can never predict these things, but
yeah.
I don't see it falling significantly from current levels. In fact, it's going to go up.
At 30, how prospectively profitable will prospect be?
Well, bear in mind that what we've got in Italy is an onshore well, which is already tied in. The operating costs of our joint venture are extremely low. We can make money at prices far lower than 30. So if it's 30, we'll be doing just fine. And that's what the numbers I quoted before were based on the 30 or 35 current gas prices. With prices higher than that, we're just making further revenues and further cash. So that's good news.
So at a current market capitalization of 24 million, with your predictive situation over the next 12 months, if the price stayed the same, which hopefully it's not going to, but if it did, what would the PE be in terms of prospect energy at sort of 24 million market capitalization?
I'd be disappointed if we weren't double that, you know, when we're in production and with further wells in the pipeline to drill. So that's
what But the question I'm asking is, if the price didn't go up, what would be the price earnings ratio based on a 24 million market cap and what you expect to earn?
Well, it could go. Currently, it's around two or three, as I said. It's going to go double that at the current gas prices. So if we see gas prices firm up, it's just going to keep rising because we're in production on a low-cost basis with further wells to be drilled on the concession in Italy and hopefully in Spain as well by the beginning of 2024.
Yeah. So a 2-3 PE ratio on an energy supplier with tied in gas and basically gas that's being sold at TTF prices with a premium, but then obviously you've got some delivery costs to take off, seems a bit mad in this marketplace.
Yeah, well.
You're allowed to say you said it, not me.
Yes. Well, I happen to agree with you. I think that the marketplace is mad. I mean, I can't predict what AIM stocks do. You know, we put out good news and our share price doesn't react hugely. It's firmed up a bit, but often with AIM stock, people sell into the good news. So yeah, that's just the way it is. I'm a realist.
Yeah, I think people are going to have a very different view in 3 to 6 months when you have a large amount in your bank account and everybody's thinking, ooh, there's money.
Yeah, indeed.
But Mark, I have one last question. Because this is now the summer and it's the Sunday roast, we want to ask you, what is your favorite thing to put on your barbecue?
Oh, it has to be homemade beef burgers.
Homemade beef burgers. And how would you make those homemade beef burgers, Mark? Is this your forte?
Secret recipe. I just had one last night with my family.
Is this your forte? You're the chef in the house to make these?
I do a bit of that, yeah.
You should try smash burgers. Get the griddle really hot and then make the mince. And then you basically smash them down with like a big heavy weight on some greaseproof paper. And it caramelizes, because you get it so hot, it caramelizes the crust and you get a really nice thin kind of patty. It's really nice. Smash burgers. Have a look at it.
Yeah.
And if you want to go the extra mile, you have smash onion burgers. You put onions on the other side and then smash them in. But anyway, less of food because it's making me hungry now.
Yeah.
Right.
Crazy. Thank you.
Very good. Well, I think we'll look forward to welcoming you back on in the future episodes. And we just want to say, Mark Routh, CEO of Prospects Energy, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Our next guest is Colin Bird. Welcome back, Colin. How's life treating you?
Not too badly at all, thank you. Not too badly at all, no.
Yeah, good, thanks. Weather's been a lot better over here, so it's finally feels like we've got summer. But so it's been a while since we've had you on. I mean, do you want to give the listeners an overview of African Pioneer, who you're obviously executive chairman of, please?
Well, African Pioneer has moved, hasn't it, in 2023, and moved quite well. I guess, you know, you can't start comparing the Ongomba project in Namibia with what we're doing in Namibia with what we're doing in Botswana, because they're all quite unique in their own way. But of course, we're not ranking, we're just talking at the moment. Let the listeners rank. But to me, discovery of the Kamoa style mineralization by the option, you know, the First Quantum got an option on our project, the undoubtable discovery of Kamoa, follow on of the Western Forelands, Kolwezi style mineralization, you know, in this exploration business, if you've got one shot, you're quite lucky. We've got three shots. You know, they've got the Western Foreland, which is basically Ivanhoe, Mr. Friedland's next ace. You've got Kamoa, which is his current ace, the second richest mine in the world. And of course, the Kolwezi mineralization sits on surface. And then, you know, if you want to kind of, don't let's talk about aces anymore. We're not gambling. Let's talk about the fact that in association with the copper, good grades of copper over in the Kolwezi, is cobalt. So quite, you know, put that together, you've literally got three targets, the Western Foreland, the Kamoa, and that Kamoa is outstanding, you know, they're working 5% copper. And the Western Forelands is very similar. And then if you start talking on surface, good percentages of copper with extremely good percentages of cobalt, you really have got something very, very superior. It represents a transformational discovery for Zambia, for First Quantum, and of course, we little boys at the back end of the queue there, but it's our project, represents something which, in my wildest dreams, when we signed up with the guys a couple of years ago, over a year and a half ago, in the wildest dreams, you couldn't have expected. And, you know, I don't know if you follow, probably you don't follow that specifically, but I'm very careful to watch Ivanhoe and comment, press comment on Ivanhoe. And I saw the press comment the other day. They're seeking a junior partner for the Western Forelands. And if you go back 2 years, they rejected BHP for $1 billion as a junior partner. So there we sit again with a market cap of about best part of 4 or 5, and with probably the best exploration ground, three shots really of the gun, currently earning into joint venture rights in a country which is the focus, most of the major explorers. That has to be, you know, if you say what's going on at African Pioneer, that has to be the most overlooked situation in the entire aid market. And I'll stand and defend that one against anyone. We look at Ongombo, and there we picked up Ongombo. We picked it up as a nice, neat little project with 10 million tons of ore. The more we worked it, the more we realized the opportunities were there. So we've proved up an open cast start to our activities when we're turning it into a mine. We've got a mining license. We've got the environmental initial permit. We've turned 10 million into 29 million tons. And we've discovered, lo and behold, that previous explorers did not even in the main chute, which gets quite wide in places, gets really not the main chute because I'm mixing up the names there and the nomenclature. In actual fact, the east chute. The reason I use the word main is because it's big. You know, it really is a big chute. And there's some great thicknesses there, some very nice thicknesses. But for whatever reason, Phil, they didn't test for gold. So we're going to twin a few holes there. And that's basically going to enhance, enhance the tonnage by bringing in certain areas, which might not have been in the calculation. But secondly, of course, increase the value in terms of your copper equivalent will be lifted. It also, you know, the closer you get and the more work you do, you're going to go one way, south and north. But this is going the right way, everything we look at. And it lends itself beautifully on the basis of about a 6 or 7 degree plunge. Of being a plunged mining project. So we don't have to chase it down dip on full dip. We can actually break it in this thing. And of course, if we're doing it ex the open pit, what a nice situation to be in. So we can go down on the open pit, ex the open pit for our key drives. And then we can do what you call strike driving. That means lateral drives, probably about 40 meters apart, and join them up with stope pillar. So really, it's not 4 years at King's College for that one, or Imperial College or Camborne. You know, it really isn't. It's very nice muck shifting. And we've re-looked at the mining widths as well. And we reckon we'd probably be mining about 1.6. So if all the miners were my size, it'd be great. If you're 1.8 meters, 2 meters tall, you might have to bend your head now and again. But it's better than crawling around in that silly prognosis that that we had inherited, i.e. 1 meter, you know. You will not believe in terms of mining thickness, and I'm a mining engineer, you will not believe how difficult these 0.8 meter, 1 meter ore bodies are to work in. It's difficult, Bowles. It's difficult to move around. You rely more on fixed supports as opposed to root bolts and rebar. So the safety factor is affected somewhat. So, you know, I'm a lot happier at chap working in 1.6 meters. And the issue definitely shows a tendency to be, wide and thick and out sort of shoots off the chute. So very, very excited about Ongombo. We ain't done yet. We're waiting for the final resource. It would be probably wrong to, it would be wrong and incorrect, in fact, on this podcast to say what we expect the new resource to be. You know, it's certainly going to be more, but you're not talking about doubling or anything, but it will be finite, and it will be mine planning standard, and we just have to drill those probably be 5 holes where we twin to check what the gold values are. Ongombo, are we excited? Yeah, we are. We've got everything in place now, mining license and everything, so that's good. And then over in the Kalahari there, our Sandfire venture, they're doing their stuff. I think they're sort of sampling at the moment. We're doing pretty much the same. There's a metal source sampling been developed, which in actual fact assists a stank. It wasn't possible a while ago because the source sampling got the limitation that the ore was about 50 or 60 meters, then probably the copper wouldn't have leached the surface. And so therefore, whether the copper was there or not, you wouldn't have the indication, especially in extremely dry desert condition, as you can imagine, to get leaching a good source sample results to the surface from something which is 50, 60, 70 meters below is difficult enough. If it's very dry, arid desert conditions, there's no real inducement for a copper to make its way up into surface to get a differential copper result. So, but there's a new method out which corrects all of that, and not corrects it, but handles it. And so we're using that as our buddy's Sandfire. So put a circle around African Pioneer. We like it. We like it a lot. We really do.
I mean, in a nutshell, you've effectively got three, large projects there. As you mentioned, you've got the Zambia, Northwest Zambia with a major First Quantum there, obviously, and similarities in mineralization to the Kamoa Kakula deposit. And you've got you mentioned the Ongombo copper project in Namibia. And I believe, as you just alluded to, with a 25-year mining license granted. And then there was a recent RNS release, wasn't there, with the drill program resulted in an additional 100,000 tons of contained copper metal and 84,000 ounces of gold across the resource categories. And then, as you alluded to just now, you've got the Kalahari Copper Belt in Botswana under the Sandfire option agreement. I mean, did you ever think that you'd have this such sort of large assets within well, it's not even a small cap company, is it? You could call it a nano cap company on the standard list.
No, I didn't. Do you know that I discovered our team. And the Anglo'd had 10 years there, and all the clever boys and the PhDs have been one. And in 19 months, we'd colonized every single theory before. We'd proved up 1.5 billion tons at 0.69, I think it was, and sold it for 260 million. Dwarfs it. What we've got in African Pioneer dwarfs that. It actually dwarfs it.
And with the likes of Ivanhoe, as you just alluded to earlier on, sort of adding, I think they've just announced that they're going to pump something like $19 million into exploration in that area. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, you know, we find those guys around all over the place. The Ivanhoe team, $19 million, it's quite an exploration spend. I suspect that will be done in Comox extensions and the Western Foreland. It doesn't show a negative commitment, does it? It shows an absolute positive commitment. They don't, you know, I mean, Mr. Freeland is Mr. Freeland, but I mean, with the chest of assets that he's got in the Congo, in that part, he really doesn't have to go anywhere else. He really has got, he's got the crown jewels.
Yeah, I mean, they've announced two significant finds, haven't they? The Makoko and the Kiala, which they're saying could feed ore into the Kamoa Kakula the copper complex.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, it is so, what's the word, fertile. It is so, so rich in copper, that entire area. And we're part of it. And I Phil, for the life of me, when people talk about the Congo fence, you know, what they've got in the Congo and what you've got in Zambia. God put the copper in the ground hundreds of millions of years ago. And that fence put up, you know, between Congo and that political fence, was put up quite recently. In fact, in terms of geological time versus real, you know, today time, you know, the political fence was put up yesterday. So it makes absolute nonsense. And we're in the same rocks. The rocks suddenly stop in the Congo border there, you know, go a different color and say, well, that's Ivanhoe over there. That's Mr. Friedland. He's good. He's done extremely good. And over the other side, that's Gondlinburg. He hasn't done so good. And those rocks are pink. You know, the same rocks, Phil, the same rocks. Same geology, same structures, the same driving forces. When it all happened, you know, millions of years ago, when it all happened, it was the same forces, the same dynamics which produced these bodies. And, you know, we are very happy. The market essentially needs I don't think it needs persuading. I think the market is basically, has now stepped back, is looking at the world, not looking at African Pioneer, not looking at the AIM market, not looking at the Toronto market. I think smaller cap investors are basically taking one big step back, taking one big breath. They don't really, I don't think the small cap investors, they don't really believe the copper story yet either, Phil, even though it's hitting you in the face as hard as it possibly can. And again, you know, step back, look where we are now at the copper price, look back 10 years, look where we are today. And have you ever seen such headwinds against, you know, waiting for recession, waiting for more interest rates, war escalating by the day, crazy things happening, and yet copper is very resilient and very strong.
Yeah, I think people do believe it. The problem is that both the capital and their patience are being tested. This is the problem. And when those things are tested, then people have one choice, don't they? They either sit there on their hands or they get out. And I think a huge number of them decide the second one and not the first one when the opportunity for extreme amounts of upside in some of these companies is there for all to see. You recently raised some money with AFP, so what position does that put you in with AFP in terms of forward in Ongombo and, you know, you've got a free carry on the other two, so what's the situation there?
Yeah, well, just before I answer that, I'll go back to your last point and say, I think, you know, we've talked about all those external forces and boy, they're big. But I think we really do need a win, you know, that the market, I think I've said it in a previous podcast, but I think the AIM market, the Toronto market, all of them looking for win. I can't remember the last one, a real significant, you know, where a company started from scratch and came out with a massive sale. Hopefully it'll be us, but there are a few other companies as well with nice assets, bless them. And, I'm not a jealous person, but somebody is going to start the ball rolling, and I think the start will probably come from a win. But that raising last week, you know, we're on the LSE, you know that, of your issued share capital. We didn't really want to go through the summer We didn't think that was smart. Summer came early and summer might last longer in these depressed times. So we thought we'd better ensure the treasury was safe. And then, of course, we've got the options of one has to write a mini prospectus, if you like, for the next round. But there won't be a next round very soon. And it was prudent. It was wise. Would have liked to have done it at a much bigger price. I think you know that. I certainly know that. But it is what it is. And as directors, we've got a fiduciary duty to keep the company funded. We've got a fiduciary duty to do all of those good things. And so the timing was right, because I talked to a couple of brokers last week, and they said every time they call the bottom, a new one comes in. So you've got to be very careful about assessing that, you know, that markets have bottomed. You've got to be very careful, because every day sees a new low. I'm watching companies go from 6 to 9 back to 6 in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, and they're companies who are producing $60-70 million worth of cash a year. So not a pretty picture. And I think that if your investors are interested, and I know, Kevin, I know that people are interested in African Pioneer. I know that the market out there know that if there's going to be a 10 bagger, you know, we're in position to be one of the candidates. The market knows we're in the right country. But as you said, maybe the thinking now has reached the investing community, small cap investing community, that pound, basically, instead of it burning a hole in your pocket to put into a junior mining company, might be better to stay in your pocket. And maybe it's as simple as that, Kevin.
Yeah, time will tell.
So, Colin, thanks very much for your time, and we look forward to welcoming you back on in the future.
Thank you, Phil. Enjoyed talking to you, as always.
So our next featured company is a mineral exploration company focused on tungsten, gold, copper, silver and zinc within Nevada, US, and a relative newcomer to the AIM market. We welcome Oliver Friesen, CEO of Golden Metal Resources. Welcome back, Oliver. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well, gents. How are you guys doing? Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, it's all good here. It's enjoying the weather.
Yeah, we had some nice hot weather in London here, but now we're, I think, back to normal and about 20 degrees and overcast. So,
yeah. How does it compare to your average Canadian summer?
It's a good question, actually. But funny enough, I'm from Vancouver originally, and Vancouver notoriously has impeccable summers. I mean, we're talking kind of 25 degrees and sunny for about 3 months straight. We don't talk about what happens the other 9 months, but Vancouver, I think, takes the cake. But
it's
London's not too bad.
Beautiful city, isn't it? And then in winter, yeah, you can go off snowboarding and do all your winter sports. Pretty
exciting. Exactly. Yeah, it's an outdoor paradise for sure.
Good. So for the listeners who probably, you know, don't know the Golden Metals Resources story, do you want to just give a sort of brief outline and walk us through exactly what it is that Golden Metal does, please?
Yeah, of course. So we, as you mentioned, a newcomer to the London markets here. We trade on AIM under the symbol GMET, GMET. We actually listed on May the 10th. So we've been around for just over 6 weeks now. You know, those listeners who followed the story a little bit, you'll see that we've been quite active in those 6 weeks, which I think should signify kind of who we are as a company and how we're pushing our narrative forward. But we are a Nevada pure play focused company. Reason being, we wanted to bring, which is the top rated mining jurisdiction in the world in Nevada, to the London market, so investors here can get exposure to what is a fantastic place to explore as well as develop. So we've certainly done that. We have 4 assets in the portfolio. The flagship asset is the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the United States of America, which is really important right now because China is currently the world's largest supplier and miner of tungsten, producing almost just over 80% of the total global annual tungsten supplies. And they're actually currently the United States' largest import partner. And the U.S. has no active tungsten mines. So we're looking to sort of solve the problem. I know it's very front and center for a lot of investors right now, which is this sort of monumental shift where countries are now looking to shore up their domestic supplies of strategic, critical, and defense metals. And that's certainly the narrative that we're playing into, owning 100% of this Pilot Mountain project. So we're very much an exploration-focused company. We have some really good exploration upside at Pilot Mountain, but also a really exciting development pathway as well, where we're looking to talk to and tap into non-dilutive funding through the U.S. government as they look to help shore up domestic sources of critical minerals, including tungsten.
Yeah. I mean, since you're listing in May, as you alluded to, I think it's fair to say that you've had a lot of, you know, news, good news, frequent news, including a signed letter of intent with Global Tungsten and Powders for a tungsten concentrate offtake agreement at the Pilot Mountain project, and also announced the discovery of 3 significant undrilled exploration targets. So do you think the market has yet to sort of like discover that the fact that how significant that news is really?
Yeah, you know, I think honestly, it's partly to do with when we're putting this news out, which is in the summer. I think especially in the UK, obviously people like to take the time off, which I fully respect. So it's a little quiet, but we're obviously working on getting the message out. You know, we're a newcomer to the market here. So I think, you know, half the battle is really just getting people aware of the story. And then as we continue to put news out, I think the market's really going to wake up here as to what the potential is here and how we've already added considerable value to the portfolio since we listed only about 6 weeks ago. So as you mentioned, some very important news came out. It's actually five targets now, Phil, that we've identified. So very, very large footprint there. We think with those targets, we can very materially increase what we have in the ground right now at Pilot Mountain, which, as I mentioned, is already the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the U.S. So we think we can very materially increase what we have right now. And then as you mentioned, the offtake agreement, that is obviously to do with the tungsten that we have in the ground right now. That was signed with a company called Global Tungsten and Powders, which is the largest tungsten processing company in the United States of America. So very great, you know, the perfect partners to have for this particular project. We are on U.S. soil. We are looking to hopefully mine tungsten, have that tungsten go into the U.S. supply chain. So having a partner like GTP come on with that agreement, I think is obviously a huge bonus, and we're very excited about that development. So there's a lot to be done now, but you know, we're making some really positive strides already.
That's good, Oliver. I now understand you will never forget my birthday because your company came to the market on my 55th birthday. Okay, so I'd just let you know. So I'll send you the address if you need to send me.
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay, so yeah, this is a sure sign of the market is sleeping at the minute. Because in my view, you've had two monumental RNSs this week, and really the dial hasn't moved. So tell us, obviously, I think most people understand you've got an offtake agreement and it's with the GTP or whatever the acronym is for them. But what magnitude is this at? You know, what size of offtake agreement have you agreed?
Yeah, so the various things that are outlined in the agreement, Kevin, are first of all timing. So the range of dates effectively that we can deliver tungsten to GTP's front doorstep. The other one is pricing as well as discount. And then the other major one is volume. So one of the things that we've included in the agreement and in the RNS is the volume that we've outlined, which is 50,000 MTUs, which can be mutually agreed to increase to about 70,000 MTUs. So in terms of the scoping study that was put out by the previous company, that accounts for roughly between 50 to 75% of projected production. That was based on the previous scoping study that was put out. However, as mentioned, there's a really, really important exploration story here. And, you know, we are an exploration company. I'm an exploration geologist by trade. So those five targets that we briefly touched on before, I think there's a great opportunity to increase what we have in the ground right now. So that obviously, the offtake is to do with what we currently have defined within the resource at Pilot Mountain. But there's certainly going to be an opportunity to drill some of these targets and hopefully very materially increase the size of what we have.
Okay, so I just want people to understand the magnitude of this. I'm right with you because there are five other targets here, as you rightly said. So we could be talking about several magnitudes higher than the 50,000 MTU. But what sort of, at the current prices of MTU, of tungsten, which we think is around the 300 to 335 mark, do we think that the revenue will be produced from this deal?
Yeah, so that's a good question, Jets. I'll have to quickly just run the numbers here. But, you know, it's sort of in the ballpark of about 15 to 20 million US per annum on the low end there. As mentioned, that figure covers about half of what the projected actual production would be. However, it's important to caveat, there's a lot of work still to do here. This is just, we have to actually figure out how we can finance this and push this project forward. But just to give listeners sort of a rough steer as to what the numbers look like based on what the volume quantities outlined in the agreement are, that's roughly the ballpark we're talking about here.
Yeah, and as you say, that's half. So the other half of the offtake is obviously, or not offtake, the other half, the 100 million MTUs, or not 100 million, 100,000 MTUs is going to be the same again, I would imagine. And then you have 3, 4, 5 opportunities to increase with the other mining targets for the tungsten, which it looks very, not likely, but it seems realistic that you're going to find more tungsten in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we definitely think that we can certainly do that. And it's also important to note that the previous operator on the project actually put out and published an exploration blue sky paper or report on what they thought was still to be found at Pilot Mountain. And on the low end, it increased the current in-ground resource by about 2x. And on the high end, that was about 3x. So that was published previously. But obviously, with the additional work that we've done with the geophysics, there's an opportunity to, and we've found some additional new targets. So that's certainly a very important part of the story here is the exploration upside and looking to tap into some of these new targets.
Okay, so why I'm excited about this company is probably, as a mining company, is probably the second RNS you issued this week, which was basically to say, hey, the US government is probably going to help you fund this. So give us some background on this. You've obviously had contact with a US agent in terms of the people who want to create the security in this metal for many different reasons, both probably military and other reasons within the US. So give us a bit more background on this.
Yeah, of course. And that's a really good question. It was actually the reason we put out the news this week was it was one of the main inbound questions I've been getting is, okay, what's the strategy around United States awards? I mean, if you look at the AIM market alone, there's very few companies, if any, other than us, who are eligible to receive potentially U.S. government funding to help us push this project forward. And it's also really important to note that the U.S. government funding is non-dilutive, which is obviously a word that investors and potential investors love to hear. So we've outlined what our strategy is in that regard. Unfortunately, for those who have actually read the RNS, what we've said is we can't really say too much at this point. However, what I can say is it's a really important part of our strategy. We actually appointed Ms. Chang Turkmani, who's a very impressive individual. She's on our advisory board now.
Try saying that after you've had a couple of drinks. I'm not sure you're going to be able to manage it.
So she's our U.S. strategic government advisor. Reason we brought her on is she lives in Washington, D.C. She's, you know, rubbing elbows with people on Capitol Hill. She's very well connected with the U.S. government, and she's also very connected when it comes to grants, grant funding, and other individuals. So she's a really important part of the team now. I work with her quite closely as we look to identify the various grants that we are eligible for. And as mentioned, it's a really, really important part of our strategy. But the takeaway point is it's going to be ticking away in the background in terms of the grants that we're applying for. And then as soon as we can announce to the market, we have further updates as to how those applications or different grant funding pathways are looking, we'll certainly announce that. But we're in a very unique position, which I think is really important for listeners to understand, owning the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the U.S.
And it's really is in their interest, in the U.S. interest, to reduce their reliance on imported critical and defense metals. They've stressed that so many times, haven't they, in the past?
It's one of the most important things right now, especially with global tensions where they are right now. It's really front of mind for the Biden administration to start to find ways to, you know, reduce their reliance on unfriendly countries for a lot of metals, and tungsten is certainly one of them because it has pretty significant defense applications as well.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about it now, but you do also have a gold project in Nevada as well, which you will be forwarding as well. So we will look forward to more information on that as time goes by as well.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting one, Kevin. And for the listeners who are familiar with Nevada Gold, they'll know that the likes of Barrick Gold and Newmont have created their companies on the backs of what's called Carlin-type gold in Nevada. So we have a really exciting and really interesting Carlin-type gold property in northern Nevada. Sort of, if you look at our website, you'll see some of the monster gold mines that are pretty close to our project. So we won't go into too much detail today because Pilot Mountain certainly is the focus and there's so much meat on the bone there, but there's a lot of other really good gems in the portfolio that investors would get exposure to as well.
So here we are. It's summer in the UK. Obviously, what is a Canadian? I mean, if you were back home now, weather's going to be good, presumably. What would be your summer Sunday roast?
Oh, that's a great question, gents. You can't go wrong with a burger. You're a little boring, I apologize.
Burger, Kev, as well.
Second burger.
You can't go wrong with a burger.
A homemade burger, so any speciality type burgers?
Just a good beef burger, done right, cheese on there, all the fixings, grill the bayam.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's summer in Canada, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good.
Oliver Friesen, CEO of Golden Metal Resources, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, gents, and I'm sure we'll be chatting again soon.
And now we welcome back Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Galileo Resources. Welcome back, Colin. It's been all of 5 minutes.
Yeah, well, nice to be back. Not much happened in the last 5 minutes, but nice to be back.
Very good. So do you want to give the listeners an overview of all the many assets within Galileo Resources, please?
Yes. Where to start? We put an announcement out the other day about Shinganda. You know, Shinganda's been going on maybe a year and a half again, and hasn't it put out interesting news releases? You know, over on the west there, iGold, Lowish Copper, on the, sorry, that's on the west, on the east, to the way round, where the copper values have been high and the gold has been a little bit lower. So many pits, so many trenches, all positive. 50-meter boreholes at 1.5%. Confounding geophysics, which was done by Vale, you know, the Brazilian company. And again, they didn't follow through. I think they decided to leave Africa, thank God, because they left us with a pretty good database. You know, the geophysics, I don't know if you know the expression, Phil, noisy. You know, you're kind of looking for a theme, you know, and there's too much scatter and too much population of imagery, if it, no matter whether you're using magnetics, EMI, IP, whatever. There's too much information, and you can't really condense it. And we've again found new techniques where, in actual fact, we can get rid of that scatter. We found an amazing phenomenon, and when we put it, it's not amazing, it's just, no, it's, why call it amazing? We found a drive-in phenomenon, which, if you put previous work superimposed on top, Brazilians got the Herrart trend, which is a very lengthy trend, which they suggested was the orientation of the mineralization. The work we've done, and it's statistically a math-based, really, new modeling, has found out, in actual fact, it's not the east-west trend which is the driver, but it's the north-south faulting and structures and lineaments that cross-cut that. And if we put our work on top, we find that essentially X marks the spot. And so now what we've done over the last 2 months or so, we've been in there when we'd been cross-cutting all of these joints, all of these faults, splays, call them what you like, you know, a splay will be, you know, you've got a pretty, and off it comes little minor faults, and we've been investigating those splays. Now we know what drives that mineralization, and we're going to test it. Shinganda, over the last couple of years, well, we've only been there again about a year and a half, but over that period, it's been, you know, we try to keep a league table, Kevin, Phil, we try and keep a league table of where the most prospectivity is, but, you know, and where the money is best directed and money and resources being combined directed. And it's getting up towards the top of the list now, Shinganda. It could well be an IOCG. Academia have gone on about IOCGs since 1960s. But who's tested in those central copper belt? Juniors. What's the first thing a junior does? Gets very disappointed if the first two or three holes, whether he does or not, his shareholders does, the first two or three holes come out bum. And that's the end of that. No more money for that project. When in actual fact, the IOCG traditionally is 250 to 300 meters below surface, trapped by an intrusion. Nobody bothered to do that. Nobody's taking the time to test that. We're 5 minutes away from testing that. We keep getting this constant result, this constant trend, join it all up. We know now where the aematite is focused. We know where the saprolite is. We know where the joints are. And we know where the geophysics and the geochemistry and everything, and our own pitting drives us, and that's what we'll do. So we're happy with that, Shinganda. We're really happy with it.
Yeah, just for listeners who might not know what an IOCG is, it's an iron oxide copper gold deposit. So it's always worth just getting that in there. And just to tell us how significant and important and highly valuable that they are, Colin.
Well, it's right in the Mount Isabees of Australia. That's the main mines. They don't come as high grade. They come generally 0.6, 0.7 copper and about the 0.6, 0.7 grams of gold. But they come as quite huge deposits. They're mostly broken up, but they're broken up into really meaningful sized deposits. You know, big one would be 300 million tons. A typical one would be 120 million tons. And quite easy to mine because, you know, I talked about pooling underneath an intrusive. That's essentially what it, you know, in sort of layman's terms, that's essentially what it is. So let's call it Mount Isa style mineralization, Australian style mineralization for copper gold. And they are characteristic. The appearance is everything we've got. You know, you get a stack of aematite, this, you know, which is obviously in its own right. You get the malachite. You get extremely high grades, which are just untypical. And where do you find those? You find them on joints, and joints being faults. Why do you find them there? Because it's plumbing, it's fluid dynamics. When you came from the center of the earth, and the, you know, that massive flow of molten material, it couldn't get through the intrusives, could it? So it pooled. And then it blows out through the adjacent faults, and forms these breccias. And so then you get the surface indication. And that's exactly what we've got at Ashen Gander. So I'm not going to bet any bottom dollars because I'm in the business of exploration. But boy, you know, you've got every single indicator of the joints, you know, the faulting being extremely high grade where the fluid could get through.
Yeah,
you see the expression on surface, assay tested as well as XRF tested in the laboratory.
Yeah.
So again, it's two targets, you know, it's going back to a previous conversation today, you know, that you've got a long, long strike. Where the IOCG sits, it's quite going to be anybody's guess, and you're going to have to be quite clever to get to the deduction of where it sits. But you know, I, Colin Bird, for one, will be happy if I get 4 or 5 kilometers of continuous mineralization with those 50-meter intervals at, I think it was 1.5, 1.6% with some gold. But in the back of my head, you know, back to if I had any dreams when we took Shingander on, is that IOCG there? And we're in with a good chance of an IOCG.
Very good. So you also had some news out this week that basically to the market that you discovered substantial gold targets in the vicinity of the Queen's Mine near Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. Do you want add a bit of colour to that, please, Colin?
Well, there's a stack of colour there, isn't there? You know, that's been going for many years as Queens. And Queens has been in and around Queens. You have artisanal mining. It's only 20-odd kilometres from Bulawayo, near, you know, a town. But you've had more than artisanal. You've had real mine. But when you call it a real mine, and if you put it in international terms, it's a very small mine, doing about 40 kilos, I think, around about 40 kilos a month. Very nice, if you want my opinion. But, you know, nobody's gone for the big target. I'm going for the big target. When we announced that we acquired BC Ventures, you remember we, quite surprisingly for everybody, we announced that we were going to do an airborne survey, which was going to cost us $200,000. We did it. Of course, that's what's done all this pointing. And have you ever seen 2.1 in soils before, Phil? I am. And they're very, very good samples. The area is big. The propensity is good in a known mining district with artisanal miners. And we're good at this at our social requirements, but didn't need any ESG laws, rules, and governance. I've been ESG conscious since I first stepped down a mine. You know, you have to share, these places are dangerous and hostile, and you develop your own standards. You don't need a book 500 pages thick. You need your own brain, look in the mirror, and that's where you develop your standards. So, you know, we'll be able to form a mine, which is basically environmentally as good as anywhere in the world. The ESG is good anywhere else in the world. And instead of having a bunch of artisans, who are now going and doing rough, rough mining, let's call it rough mining, I think they'll be working with us. So we've done a lot of social on-ground work as well. So, and that's ESG, yes, that's good governance, yes. But it's even better governance because they'll be working with us. So we're very excited about that. But you didn't mention the ultramafic. We've got the big ultramafic there with the nickel. And that is very, very, very important. I'm for drilling a hole in it, but I think, you know, prudence says that we probably should do an IP over this 1.5 to 2 kilometers. Do IP first to see which is where the nickel at what depth appears. But we've had very good nickel grades on surface, so that's something we didn't expect, Phil. But here we are. You know, we've sat here, the three of us. We've talked about Shingander, Zambia. We've talked about Queens, our gold. We talked about the possibility of nickel at Queens, and we're starting drilling next week into lithium.
I'm going to say, we haven't even mentioned the Kamativan project.
Never even mentioned it. Now, 99.99% of the companies, if they've got a lithium project that we've got with the anomalies that we've got next to a mine which has been producing tin in those pegmatite belts which contain lithium, rare earths, and tantalum, and they might have started the story with that. This Galileo, who nobody seems to love very much at the moment, is so stocked up, so stocked up with goodies, it can't be true. I mean, you know, this is a very serious bag.
Bag of goodies. Colin, tell me this. Obviously, the Aframat deal also came through here in the RNS. So when this Aframat deal finalizes itself in the next, if it hasn't already, in the next few weeks, what sort of holdings will Galileo have in terms of other companies? Because it's going to hold, obviously, some of this other company and also other stuff. So what do you hold?
Oh, well, I think that's if I may say politely, it's that de minimis. It's an 8 billion rand company. 8 billion. And in today's terms, what's that divided by 22? I think it's 24. I don't know. It's a big company. It's not a mid cap, but it's nearly there.
Yeah, it's £400 million company.
Yeah, so that's fairly irrelevant. But of course, it was a decision when we decided to accept shares, Kevin, that we were dealing with a company which is highly liquid, very well thought of, with a very good asset base. So it's shares first and then the final payment in April next year. And, you know, I don't know if you probably do know this, but in South Africa, a company is measured on its dividends. So they're not shy, but it's necessary in South Africa to pay good dividends. So not only is our money sat there in shares, we will be also, might get some decent dividends before we sell the shares. And remember, we still have the Sandfire shares. And remember, we've still got cash in the bank. So quite frankly, it was no train smash when we did this deal to divide the final payment into halves. Since we also, there was a reduction in a few conditions, suspensive conditions, you know, a condition precedent. So in actual fact, it was a real negotiation, helped them, and quite frankly, put us out of the bureaucracy of getting, you know, certain permits. So it was a very good deal all round. And again, some shareholders didn't like it. I could understand if we had announced that the deal was off and we weren't getting the second payment. But the fact that we've restructured it, when the company is currently cashed up for everything it's doing, with the possibility of decent dividends, in a good company which trades well and has got a high market capitalization, I really can't see where we did the company much damage at all. In fact, I think we probably did it a lot of good. We did Galileo shareholders a lot of good because certain suspensive conditions were dropped.
What sort of value does Galileo hold in Sandfire shares?
It's the best part of $2 million at the current share price, Australian dollars.
Okay, so sort of £1 million or thereabouts, yeah?
About that, yeah, with about separate.
So, to be conservative, there's at least £3 million of other company shares within Galileo.
There's our own cash. Oh, no, it's better than that, isn't it, Phil? It's 2.5 + 1, it's 3.5 plus our own cash. We've got the best part of £4 million.
Okay, so you've got £4 million and you've got a market capitalization of £11 million. So all the products and you've got another £2 million coming next April.
Yes, indeed. It's again a little bit more than that. Yeah. That's the order, yeah.
But basically you're gonna have £6 million come April. So the net added value of all of these deals, Shinganda, Zimbabwe, the lithium, effectively are valued at £5 million.
And you forgot Lewensobi, ready for production.
Okay, yes, sorry, Lewensobi as well, yes.
What has that got? 6, 12 with underground. That's got around about 18 million tonnes. The pit is about 1%, just over 1% for 6 million tonnes. The underground is 12 and growing. It's more than survived feasibility study. We're looking at payback in around about 2.6 years. We're looking at good NPVs, good IORRs. And we've got a project which is... quite frankly, as the months go by, it's not what it appears. In some of the research what's been done, again, they're postulating that down there is a deep plunge, which may in actual fact be part of the system I was talking about in an earlier conversation with you. So there you are, you see, we forgot Lewensobi. I mean, most companies haven't even got a Lewensobi, but you've got a Kamatavi, which has been drilled next week. You've got nickel, you've got gold, evidenced. The gold is in a gold province, which has been worked for the last, I don't know, 50 years. And then you've got Shinganda, which basically has produced all those good olds, all in one company, all with a market cap, which is virtually insignificant, and a share price, which again has dipped below a penny. But what's the point of me crying in my beer about the share price? It's absolutely no sense at all. We're cashed up to get on with what we need to do. And as I've said, this market, all markets, Toronto, Australia, need a real discovery. And if ever you saw a portfolio widespread enough in all of the right new age metals, then Galileo is the company, isn't it? It just has to be, Kevin.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely.
Certainly sounds very exciting. And we look forward to welcoming you back on in future episodes to give the listeners an update on progress. So just want to say thanks very much again, Colin, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.
And on to our next guest, a mining development and exploration company focused primarily on precious and base metals. We welcome Sean Day, MD of Greatland Gold. Good day, Sean. It's great to have you back.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Kevin. Thank you very much for having me back on the Sunday Roast program.
Yeah.
So it's good to see you with a coat on, Sean, now, because we're boiling hot here and you're freezing to death, which is great.
It is actually bitterly cold here, so our houses are made to dissipate heat rather than retain it, so you do feel the cold.
Cairo's the same. In the winter, we can't explain how cold it is inside. It's warmer outside than inside.
So for those listeners who don't know the Greatland story, please, can you give a quick run through as to what the company's all about?
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Look, you know, we have a world-class deposit in Havieron. It's a gold copper deposit in the north of Western Australia. It sits just 45 kilometres from existing infrastructure, the Telfer mine, which is coming to the end of its life. So Havieron is a ready-made new lease of life for that infrastructure. We have already over 6.5 million ounces of high-grade ore delineated, and that will continue to grow. And you know, we are 2 years into a three-year development phase. So we are coming to a point where in 2024, we'll be stoping our first gold and copper ore out of the Havieron ore body.
Very good, Sean. So tell us a little bit about what's been happening this year, I suppose, the last 6 months. I mean, really, this is the review, the mid-year review of a lot of the stocks. So tell us what's been happening in this 6 months and what we anticipate will happen in the next 6-12 months.
Well, in the last 6 months, I think we've continued to make great progress on a couple of fronts. We've updated our board. We've brought in a new chairman and deputy chairman. And I think that's one of our competitive advantages is the quality of the people, both at particularly at a board level, but also I like to think equally at the management level and you know, the team we've brought into the organization. You know, secondly, a focus for us in the past 6 months has been setting ourselves up to add an ASX listing to complement our existing London listing. And we're going to keep both. We celebrate and appreciate what we have in London, but we're really excited about adding the ASX to that. And in particular, the ASX is a resources exchange. We are an Australian asset, an Australian management team, an Australian peer group. We think we're really well placed and we already have attracted Australian institutions. And a number of those Australian institutions are mandate locked, i.e. they're only allowed to invest in ASX stock. They can come and buy the stock in London, but we have to be ASX listed. London will presumably be where, you know, we continue to have the deepest and most liquid market. And that should attract the institutional buying there. But we think this complements the platform we have wonderfully well. And we believe we're on track to complete that in the September quarter of 2023. But that's been a huge amount of work. And in parallel to that, we've had an incredibly successful program of development. So we continue to get ever closer. We're on our third of four spirals into the Havieron ore body. And then the other, I think, incredibly exciting news is Rio Tinto Exploration selected Havieron to be their partner in the Paterson. This is without doubt the best ground, untested ground in the Paterson. And we are the manager of that. Within inside of 4 weeks of signing that agreement, we've already got a drill rig spinning on it as we speak. And these target the confluence of gravitational gradients, conductivity, and magnetics are just exceptional. They look more like Havieron than Havieron does. So we're incredibly excited. It's a
Does this mean geologists are actually getting excited?
Mate, our geologists, you know, running around the office giving each other high fives. They are absolutely rapt. To be back in there. So, and you know, I didn't dictate that you had to take the rigs up there straight away. Mate, they were just about carrying them up there. So it's good. It's good. And look, you know, there's a number of high quality targets. We'll systematically work through them. But if there's another Havieron, another Telfer, another Winu up in the Paterson, you know, we've got the right ground to be looking for it. And it's elephant country if you do tag one of these things.
Yeah.
And you had the recent drilling results. I think the intersected intervals, was it 32 meters at 6.6 grams per ton of gold and like 0.26% copper. What are you, I mean, they're going to be incorporated into the ongoing feasibility study, presumably.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter this week, yeah, the I think it was the best gold intercepts of the last month or last quarter. And yeah, we're up there with, you know, I think it was a top five intercept. And really this is, the market doesn't even get excited when we put this out. Yeah, it's one of the top five intercepts on the planet, and people are just accustomed to it. To some extent, we're a victim of the ore body being so consistent and such good grade. But this is, people should, it's exceptional to have a 6.5 million ounces of high-grade gold, copper delineated, and continue to drill outside of that and keep hitting more high-grade intercepts. So, yep, we're wrapped about that. Just the other, update we gave around some of the exploration results outside of Havieron. We've also hit some mineralization. Now, that doesn't mean it's a Havieron yet, but we've certainly got some targets, some anomalies that we now know have mineralization around them that we're going to be following up. And we have some assays in now, which we're really interested to see. So, we like to think, it takes a little bit of time to solve the puzzle as to where these ore bodies are. They're undercover, but I think we're making some good progress there as well. So we feel really good about where we are, and we want to carry the market with us because that's important too. And I like to think there'll be some really positive news for the market as we explain our IPO process.
So with the sort of $3,000, Australian dollars per ounce gold, and gold, I presume, is about to come out of the ground, certainly within the next 12 months now, we'll have progressed to the middle of the year. What's it going to be looking like 12 months from now with revenue coming into the company?
Well, there's two aspects to that question. One of the lovely things here is gold is Australian $3,000 an ounce at a point in time when there's the strongest interest rate tightening cycle in the history of the United States. Now, that shouldn't necessarily be supportive of gold, and we're at an all-time high gold. So it makes me feel pretty good about where gold is headed. And then look, in terms of when we deliver first gold, there is just the good order. You hit the top of the ore body, you've got a stope, you've got a process before we actually sell our first gold. But we're really wrapped to transition from explorer and developer into what really when the rubber hits the road and becoming a producer. And the funding complexity falls away once you start generating free cash flow. So it's a huge hallmark, a huge milestone for the company. And it's exciting that we're somewhat in the home stretch.
Yeah, and I think for all the positive things, there is obviously a bit of uncertainty about certain mergers and stuff that are going on. But at the same time, your share price really has not responded to the positive news you've been putting out.
Yeah, and look, I think markets don't love uncertainty. Your hard joint venture partner, changing and to some extent that resulting in a delay in the definitive feasibility study is unfortunate. We understand it, we respect it, but we can't control the corporate position and takeover of our joint venture partner. To some extent, it's a compliment to the quality of their asset base, and Havieron Telfer is part of that, but I think there's opportunity from that as well. So I certainly see the cup half full here. I appreciate market, desire and long for that certainty, and that's not far away. But therein is the challenge and the opportunity for us. And I like complexity. We can solve complexity. We've been solving some really complex conditions at Greatland for the last 2 years. I like to think people should have confidence that we will continue to solve complexity, and that's why we invested in the team. We have a good team. And good people deliver good outcomes.
Very good.
Yeah, I was just looking. I caught something at a website that I've been keeping an eye on, Mindex, which is a site you're probably familiar with. And it appears that the Telfer Havieron gold mining project was given a tick of approval from what I can see on the 27th of June.
Yeah, look, I think technically in the sector, I think there's great reception and recognition increasingly of Havieron, and that's been hard earned over the last couple of years. You know, it was only, what, 2.5 years ago that we had our maiden resource. But as we've continued to do that, there were challenges in the ground conditions that we've overcome. And yeah, a great credit to the site team to do that. Now that we're, you know, reasonably deep through that Permian layer, as I've described, the ground conditions just continue to get better. The deeper you are, the greater the time, pressure and temperature, and the more consolidated that ground is. And then, you know, in the not too distant future, we get to the country rock, which is fantastic roof and ground conditions. So, you know, all projects have complexity. Nothing is without, you know, nothing's linear. But gosh, I think the team and also the site team, the team at Greatland and our joint venture partner as a global major is incredibly capable. And perhaps even more so if it becomes the world's largest gold miner. You know, we've got the team in place to optimize the asset.
So as we've been watching things in England from that 22-yard strip, we understand we had a great first test, but unfortunately the old enemy won, or should I say you Australians won the test match. And as we speak on Friday afternoon, England have basically thrown the second test away, having started a great deal of batting. So how smugly would you like to respond to that synopsis?
Look, I do enjoy cricket. I've been following the Ashes with great interest, and yeah, just quietly, please, but We did have a quick chat before this, and you know, look, the best Ashes series of my lifetime was 2005, which England won, and I thought that first test, England actually played the more attractive and aggressive cricket and probably should have won had Patterson not had that cameo innings. I think you're right. I think Australia might walk away with this one, but I do enjoy the contest. It's Ashes cricket is loved just as much, if not more so, in Australia than it is in England. It's this test series we all want to watch, and yeah, it's obviously Australia hasn't won everything for the last couple of years, so it's nice to actually see us get back on top. But it is I actually love England playing cricket just as well.
Can't be as bad a rivalry between Ian Botham and Ian Chappell, can it, from what I can read in the media? It sounds like these two have been warring for, you know, like last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, no, I think the Chappell brothers and Botham were pretty amazing rivalries. Yeah, look, the history of Test cricket is exceptional.
Yeah, fortunately, Wimbledon starts soon, so we can ignore the cricket for a while.
Something else we can watch drift away from us.
Indeed.
Who was it? Was it? I'm trying to remember who replaced Ian Botham as captain of the English team, Brinkley or something, but did an amazing job of just re-knitting together that English team and turning around the series. And Botham was just a star once relieved of that captaincy. It's an amazing contest.
Indeed. We will see what happens. You never know. Miracles might happen, but we need one right now.
England bats well, and the greatest off spinner of all time, Lyons, is injured, and I wouldn't estimate how important he is to the team. Without even starring, he got 8 wickets in that first test, and you wouldn't even, you know, he always delivers. So, him being out might be a little bit more important than what people appreciate. Mike Brearley was the guy I was trying to remember. He was a professional cricket captain.
Yeah,
a great man.
Good.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, on that note, I think we'll wrap things up and say, Sean, it's been a pleasure as always, and thanks very much for your time.
Lads, thank you very much, Phil and Kevin. I appreciate you taking the time to catch up.
Thank you, Sean.
So we welcome back Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Extract Resources. Welcome back, Colin.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
So do you want to just give us an update on things, how things are progressing? I think the last update we saw was back in March with the update on the open pit mining study for Bushranger. I assume it's all stations go there, right?
Yeah, not much change in terms of what we're doing, but in terms of the action and progress, a lot changed. As you know, we produced, I think it was 1.3 million tonnes of contained copper, which still makes us one of the biggest unworked blocks of copper. More importantly, it's open-ended to the northeast, open-ended to the northwest, open-ended to due west, and we haven't pursued Ascot at this stage. So
I know there's some fixation in terms of the Anglo-American deal on 2 million tons, but there's a bigger fixation in the company on saying, have we got a mine? Can we make that mine work? And what does it look like? And it became extremely apparent because of the dominance of pyrite as in the associated host material for mineralization, that all source sourcing might work. And I think I've mentioned on podcasts, and I'm sure I've mentioned in RNSs, that, you know, there are examples in the world there where 87% of the copper has been retained and 50% of the mass has been rejected. Can you imagine, Phil? Can you imagine if all of a sudden the plant is halved in size, you know, the tailings dams, everything, the way that impacts on electrical usage, crushage. I mean, the biggest cost, both capital and direct, is attrition. So if you can move the attrition, you reduce your operating costs, you reduce your capital costs. And really the effect of ore sorting is so significant that it had to be done. And yet, you know what? Read a lot of releases now. You'll see that ore sorting is coming to the fore. In fact, there has been the statement made that in the last 5 years, ore sorting has taken dominance in mineral processing research. And that's certainly true. That's certainly true. I mean, in my days... You ain't got to go back a long time, because before ore sorting was a table 6 foot wide with six women one side, six women the other, throwing the waste out or throwing the ore out, whichever they chose to select. It's come on a pace. It's automated. And some interesting models around now where ore sorting companies, in actual fact, install it free of charge and they operate it and they're paid on success. So lots of interesting things happening in that arena. But we're getting results in now. We saw good selection all to waste, and we saw the copper values could be enhanced significantly, especially the high-grade copper. That high-grade copper area, which was going to be the first 6-8 years of the mine, if you remember, that really increased to over 1% copper. But strangely enough, and I don't, possibly if you really bore down into it, it isn't that strange, the rejection was higher. The good news is that at the lower values, the upgrade again was significant to 0.35 and that sort of order. The problem I've got now is that the rejection, the figures were over the population size were a little bit spread. So we may have to do a few more tests to get the consistency of a population group, if you like, big enough to actually hang your head on the results. But we'll be doing some preliminary upgrading of the model based on what we've got. I'm expecting that, as I've said just about every podcast I have with you, we're expecting that copper boom. We did our last figures, I think, at $9,000. And at $9,000, it generated over $1.3 billion. So you could hardly call it a dud. But, you know, one's looking for an investment, an hurdle rate of return of not less than 25%. And I think that ore sorting will take us in that direction. So we will continue with that ore sorting in study. We will plug temporary numbers in just to see the effect of the sizing of the various plants, and that is very important. And we'll have to do more samples at the lower grade, not the upper grade. And it's almost looking like, why on earth would you increase the higher grade when the rejection is higher? So they will be so a sorting before the sorting, if you like. The higher grade goes through the circuit. And then the anything less than 0.32, say, will go into the true ore sorting circuit. So removing along that value curve, we're understanding what we're doing. When that's finished, we'll know whether we've got to drill to the northeast, the northwest, the south. 2 million tons of copper is nowhere near important, Phil, as important as a mine what works and gives the necessary returns on investment and the comfort to the bankers that in actual fact they will be paid. And then the whole thing works. So work in progress. And of course, there's the Anglo situation where they will speak for themselves. Of course, if we'd be wrong on this podcast, we'll see which way that goes. But that's something I can't really comment about and probably shouldn't comment about. Then, of course, the gold mine, I'm happy to say, very happy to say that that's going well. Month on month, we're seeing an increase in the amount of gold produced. We're seeing stability. We're over all of those. Well, you're never really over them all. So I don't, you know, that's probably a very dangerous statement. But the teething problems are finished. The plant works beautifully. We're getting all of the recovery levels that we expected to get. The grade is running quite nicely. We had lots of troubles in October, November, developing a protocol but for grade control. We've now got that to a fine art. We really have. When we mark out with the spray tins where we're going to blast, we're not looking for dilution. We basically know where we're going to blast. So we're getting, don't want to boast, of course it's not me anyway, it's the team on site. They're getting very good at what they do. We strengthened that team on site with a pit engineer who can kind of optimize grade and design the ongoing pit. We're doing pushbacks. We're probably lifting the tailings dam higher. And we're doing all of the things you do on a currently operating gold mine. And it's running at a rate now, I think, of around about 25,000 ounces a year. So it's a nice little operation. Concurrent with all this, we're taking samples to be taken away to the laboratory. So we're designing phase two. We've already got enough confidence to say, well, this is it. We're going to go. This is going to be a long-term mine life. And so what we should be doing is designing the sulfide plant. Don't let's call it the sulfide plant, because, you know, the more I go into this, we talk about refractory transitional, non-refractory transitional. That's a magical word, Kevin, non-refractory transitional. In the past, I guess the transitional was, well, once you get there, you're stuffed. Well, you're not. You're not far from it. We're getting, you know, the recoveries are still very, very high on a, compared to an international basis. And not all of the refractory is transitional. But on worst, you know, you've got to look at worst case, best case. And now is the time to be doing exactly what we're doing. Designing the next plant. I call it a sulfide plant. It's not a sulfide plant. It would be a flotation plant. We're designing that, costing that, and we'll be timelessly building that. In fact, I'd be surprised if by the end of this year we haven't placed all the orders and we're starting to build the extended plant. What does that do for us? We haven't got to wait until we've finished this fairbride, because there's numerous little packets of ore all over the place. Some of them will go into the fairbride plant, and some of them will go into the new plant or extended plant. We're not sure at this stage, Kevin, that we can't even justify a new plan solely for refractory transitional and sulfides. Of course, we've got stacks of it. That would give us the opportunity to, in actual fact, run two plants concurrently. And similarly, nobody ever drilled a very deep hole in that area. We still need to know where the feed source is, because I think I've said to you before that Ed Slowey, our geologist, and they don't get much better than Ed. Ed's very experienced. Says that over a relatively small area, he's never seen so many different mineralization types. There has to be a feeder somewhere, and that when time and money permits, we should really be testing that out. And so that'll be a concurrent activity. If actually, for the geologist, for pure grade control, and he has nothing to do with anything but pure grade control, we've got another geologist whose sole job is to find oxides for the current oxides and non-refractory transitional to feed the current plant. And one who is doing conceptual exploration on the surrounding area and surrounding concession. So I don't want to say I'm excited, because, you know, it's a dangerous word, but it's going extremely well. And again, if you've got a 25,000 ounces a year mine, which has got a chance of growing up to 35, you've got an infrastructure and you walk into the bank and say, you know, give us $5 million to expand this plant. It's going to be a lot easier when you've got an 18-month, two-year track record, isn't it? A lot easier. So we feel very, very, very good about Manica. It's probably throwing us between $450,000 and $550,000 a month, something, you know, in that order. So again, you know, it's $6 million a year with a market cap of what?
You've got a market cap currently of $11.4 million.
Well, there you go. You know, and flowing six a year, it's basically, it's two to, it's, we're not even two times earnings, are we?
Well, you're probably a little bit more than two times earnings, because of the ones in dollars and ones in pounds. But it's insignificant at the same time. What's happening with Kikuyu then as well?
Oh, Kikuyu, well, we've cleared it. We've pushed back. All of the benches have been pushed to where they can be pushed. It's 2.25 meters long. 2.25 kilometers long. And before we embark upon an expensive pushback, we're bringing the drill machine in to actually test, does it go deeper, and what it looks like. Because we find a cobalt band, but behind the main ore body, there runs a parallel ore body. Do we push back to get that? Is that a separate pit in its own right? How extensive it is. So we're fairly brave, but we're not cavaliers, Kevin. Some drilling would be judicious in order to design, if you like, the next 2 years of the pit.
So basically where you are, you don't need to come to the market for cash, I presume? based
not unless we make an acquisition. Not unless we make an acquisition. Yeah. I'm not saying there's one on the line there, but you know, Mark, essentially, Kevin built this business. You know, the majors are still going on about tier one projects, 1.5 to 2 million. They're on about tier two projects over 1 million. I reckon the market is going to be very, very, very hungry for 500,000+ or 500,000+ copper projects. And I'm still very much on the lookout for that sort of project. We're well placed, we're well known, we're trusted, and that marketplace is open to us. And we as a group intend to pursue it. But as we stand now, we're stable. Really wish our shareholders had better news at Bushranger. We're into a process, Merlin. Some things you cannot rush, you know, Kevin. Some things you cannot rush. You've got to do it properly. You know, you're not talking about a little mine round the corner. If we open up at Lachlan Fold, but you know, and then one of the biggest mines in the world, so you don't design them in 5 minutes. So I wish we'd have had that instant success, as do our shareholders, of 2 million and sold to Anglo. But it didn't happen that way. But we've still got the biggest discovery at the Lachlan Fold has known for many years. So please, a little patience. With that as a solid foundation, 500,000 earnings coming in from Manica, and well positioned for acquisitions which suit our overall model. It can't be too bad. It can't be too bad at Extract. And again, patience, you know, where we sit now, why would you be patient? Too many people have lost too much money to be patient. And I really do sympathize. I'm in the same boat. I've lost money across the board. Tomorrow is always going to be a better day, and then we read a new terrible horror story. But you know, I think all of us who are in this business, you, Phil, and the retail sector, we're different in a way. We, you know, we're pioneers, we're venture capitalists, and we know that not every project works, but boy, some will work, and when they work extremely well. And I think, you know, in our all of our assets, all of our stables have all got a very, very, very good chance of working, and some in a very transformational way. So I'll take this opportunity to actually thank our shareholders for the patience that they've shown to us. Yeah. And I really do want to deliver on Bushranger. I really do want to deliver on Bushranger.
Good. I appreciate you giving us those updates, and just say, Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Extract Resources, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Colin.
Well, that was certainly a lot of work put into that, interviewing all those CEOs. But I hope a lot of you listeners, or all you listeners, appreciate that, you know, what we bring to you. What do you want to say, Kev? I mean, obviously being the season finale, we've brought quite a lot of content there. Do you want to talk about the markets this week? Any stock you... I mean, we normally do the bargain of the week. Is there anything on your radar for the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, the bargain of the week, and I think it's going to be the bargain of July for me anyway, is going to be technology minerals. I mean, there's been a bit of a sell-off on Thursday and Friday for no apparent reason, not on large volume. And yeah, everything should start to fall into place, I think, in July. So I think if you look at this stock from about 1.7, 1.8p, which is what it is now, I fully expect it to be significantly higher than that by the end of July. And again, August, September, higher again, because I think it's just going to start piling out cash, basically, with the lithium-ion battery recycling is going to be in place, and the black mass is going to start to be produced, and they're going to start to produce income. And I think a lot of things are going to come from that then as well, so... Yeah, so that's stock of, let's say that's the stock of July, and let's see what happens. And yeah, my last comment is just thanks for listening to us. Yeah, we try to give you our view on the things. We are not seeing ourselves as the be all and end all in what is being said, but hopefully it's helpful, and hopefully it's helpful to listen to the CEOs. And yeah, we look forward to coming back for the new season in September. And yeah, have a great summer. We will be here in the midweek takeaways. So any information that comes from the companies, we will still be doing these recordings. But from next week till first or second week of September, we will not be doing the Sunday roast.
Yeah, it's summer season, and the market's kind of reflecting that a little bit, isn't it? The volumes have sort of tailed off a little bit. But as you say, we'll be bringing you the midweek takeaway. If there's any news releases for any of the companies, then obviously we'll get the CEOs on and let you listen to their musings. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net